Hello, I'm Seth for Privacy, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of Opt Out. Opt Out's a show where I sit down with passionate people to learn why privacy matters to them, the tools and techniques they've found and leveraged, and where we encourage and inspire others towards personal privacy and data sovereignty. Have you been wanting to get a better grasp of what the Tor network can do for your privacy and what it can't do? This episode, we're going to sit down with Isabella from Tor to chat about the Tor network itself. Welcome on to Opt Out, Isabella.
Thank you, Seth. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to sit down with you to walk through Tor, and I'm just very grateful that you were willing to come on the show. I'm sure that y'all get a ton of requests with just kind of how ubiquitous Tor is with the privacy field. But I feel like even with how well-known Tor is as a name, I feel like a lot of people still don't have a solid grasp on really its kind of core strengths and weaknesses. So I'm excited to walk through the basics, get some listener questions answered, and really just hopefully get a better grasp of Tor and what it can offer people as a tool in their toolkit after this episode. But for listeners who may not be familiar with you, do you mind introducing yourself and then just telling us a little bit about what Tor is?
Yes, I'm Isabella Bagueiros. I'm the executive director at Tor. And Tor, it's a couple of things, right? Like, first of all, Tor is a decentralized network that helps protect your original IP address when you're connecting to the internet. And we also have a browser, which is a fork from Firefox, that helps you make that connection, right? Like, so the browser also carries on some other features that protects you from fingerprinting, third-party cookies, and other tracking technologies and surveillance technologies out there. So in a very simplistic way, like, this is what Tor is. It's an open source network that helps protect your privacy online.
Perfect. And we'll kind of focus on Tor browsers today, just because I think that is the most approachable way to use the Tor network. But I think that is a very good distinction for listeners, that the Tor network itself is not necessarily the Tor browser, but the Tor browser leverages the Tor network for privacy, in addition to building in a lot of other anti-tracking features and other things on top of that. So we'll kind of focus on Tor browser today, but the Tor network is obviously the key piece that underlies that and makes the Tor browser such a powerful tool. But before we dive more into Tor itself, I actually wanted to hear a little bit more about just you and kind of your background. I love hearing what each guest kind of has as the story of kind of what woke them up to the need for personal privacy. So I'd love to hear your take on that and just, yeah.
Yes, of course. I think, so I started to get involved with the open source free software community back in the 90s. I'm originally from Brazil and was mostly out of necessity because the proprietary software was always too expensive, and keeping up with the versions would never run on my old computer. So I moved it to Linux very early on. And in the late 90s and early 2000s, I got very involved with the movement for democratization of information. And that was when the internet was kicking off and, you know, becoming stronger, especially in the global south. So during that process, kind of like start to learn as we were building tools to help democratize information through the internet, we start to learn how to host information. You know, we had to run our own servers. We created our own websites, and we had a very clear insight of the data and what controlled the data, how much a service could see and have access about your information. And in the early 2000s, we were doing digital inclusion web workshops and teaching social movements how, like, the benefits of using the internet to organize and put the information, like, be the media, right? And this is before social network and, like, Twitter or Facebook or anything like that. But at that time, we wanted to bring this awareness to folks about your data, it matters where your data is. It matters what type of service you're using. It matters if you are hosting your email with a proprietary, with a for-profit organization or with an activist organization. It matters when you publish your news and who is hosting this news, because it can be requested to take down. It can be censored. And who is going to fight for that, like to keep that information online? So very, like, it was kind of like part of my story with the internet and my story with bringing different social movements from Brazil to use the internet as a powerful tool for organizing, that notion about the information that are on devices, that are online, and who is controlling it. It, all of that matters, and the importance of caring about who is behind it. It was very important, and I try it from the early days to communicate that to people and bring that, you know, educate people and bring that awareness to people. So I think the notion of online and like privacy was came together kind of natural, because I was behind the servers. I was building the infrastructure for so many social movements, and we fought for that infrastructure to stay online. We fought against the DMCA orders and other types of orders. So we knew that there was a power that could control the information and how much you could see other people's information. So we tried to, like, I always tried to communicate that very early on in the day to other people.
Yeah, it sounds like you were very early on to that concept. And I feel like it's starting to come back around, but it's certainly... We've certainly kind of taken a dark path in the internet as a whole in the past really, I guess, decade, 15 years or so, away from what you're talking about, that idea of democratizing control of data and people very much being in control of where their data is and how it's posted and preventing censorship and all these different pieces that are, I think, kind of becoming more like privacy buzzwords now, but have been conversations for decades at this point. So it's awesome that you were early on in that, and obviously when you're a part of that, and when you understand how the actual technical details of these types of networks work, privacy becomes important, because you grasp what can happen if you don't have any kind of privacy, or if you don't have any control of the data that's being passed around there.
Exactly, I feel like two things have happened, right? One, the access to the internet have grown so much, especially right now, most people has a mobile device that can connect them to the internet. But at the same time, back in the day, the usage of data analysis and harvesting people's data was not as much as it is today. So like those are two things that influence a lot of how much people are affected by what is happening today, especially with capitalism and surveillance.
Yeah, definitely agree there. And I'd love to kind of shift back into Tor and hear a little bit more about the network itself and kind of how Tor got started. What kind of prompted the creation of Tor? And I'm assuming you weren't part of the original creation of Tor, but I'd love to hear some background on kind of where it got kickstarted, if it was out of a similar movement to that, and just a little bit of the story.
So Tor has a, I didn't create Tor, I was not part of that. But Tor has an interesting story, right? Like it actually started in the 90s, around the same time I got exposed to free software and all those service things, etc. But the US Naval Research Lab in Iraq. So literally, there were researchers there who wanted to create ways for people to have internet connections that would not reveal who they are and who they were talking with. So they developed the onion routing paper, and like later on they start to try to implement, right, the design of that paper into production, to practice. But right at the beginning of 2000s, that's when Roger Dugendyer and Nick Mefson got involved into the project, and they brought in the, you know, the clear fact that if you wanted to do the onion routing, which means like you're connecting to multiple servers until you get to the endpoint, right? Like if you want to do something like that, that are truly will truly anonymize the user connection. Nobody really would know who is connected to what. Nobody can control, could control this network. Yeah. So right at that moment, they moved the onion routing to their onion routing with the store, right? Like it stands for. And with the concept that this should be, first of all, free software, open source code. And second of all, the node should be, anyone should be part of this network and become a node. Could not be something that was a network controlled by any entity and should be decentralized. And that would be ways that that project, that right, like that concept, could exist for real in a way that nobody truly would not know who was accessing the network and doing what and communicating with who. So they remove it from inside of NRL and they open sourced the code and they created a process where then anyone could be running a node and be part of the Tor network. And to support that project, they created the nonprofit, the Tor Project nonprofit, to back that up, right? And at the beginning, this was the nonprofit was created, and all these things was formalized at around 2003, and it was sponsored by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And then the rest is history, right? Like it started to grow, more nodes, more people started running nodes. Eventually, it became, we had a little application called Vidalia that you could set up the proxy and bootstrap the network from your device. At the time would be your computer. And then you would have to configure the browser to communicate, the proxy and all of that. And then people wanted to make it easier for the user. So they actually killed Vidalia and put it, this whole bootstrapping of the network, all these pieces inside of the browser. And that's where the Tor browser came to exist, right? Like, so from the concept of like a research question, a research mission, right? Like that came actually, and people say, oh, Tor comes from the US Navy. It did from the research lab, but for the concept to really be true to itself, it had to get out of it. And then that's where Roger and me came, and they made it the code open, and they made it the network decentralized so anyone could run it, to be truly transparent and truly decentralized and true to its mission of nobody having any control of the code, of any control of the network itself. So it could really anonymize the connections through it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people get spooked by the idea that the US government obviously created Tor and thought of the way that it would function and kind of created the initial concept. But like you mentioned, the US government actually benefits from a decentralized and widespread and anonymous Tor network that's run by anyone. So if anyone's running a node and lots of people are using the network, they can benefit from that without backdooring it or having all of these kind of more, I guess, ideas that people have around the way that the US government is trying to take down Tor or whatever. But they benefit from that. And obviously, hopefully, there's that broader aim of other people are going to benefit from the privacy that's provided by the Tor network. And I'm glad that you mentioned a little bit about how the Tor network itself works, because I do think it's important that people understand at least like the rough idea. But like you mentioned, it's that onion routing, which is where when you enter the Tor network, your browser, generally Tor browser, will pick an entry node that you'll use to connect to the Tor network. Then you'll bounce through other nodes that are within the Tor network. But whenever you jump through a node, the next node doesn't know your original, your origin IP, that kind of thing. And they don't know the destination. And so you can hide that information from each of the nodes in between. And then eventually either exit through a node onto the clear net, the regular internet, and browse regular websites. And then obviously the exit node knows where you're going, but they don't know your origin IP. Or you can stay within the Tor network and use what are called hidden services, which we've talked about a good bit on the podcast in the past. But you can use basically services within the Tor network and never leave the network itself and never use an exit node. But I did just want to clarify that real quick for listeners too, because we are going to focus on Tor browser, but important that people understand how that works. But it is quite a crazy history. It's not your normal history for a free and open source project. Not many things were started out of a Navy lab and grew over the course of 20 years. So definitely not the norm, but I guess it's similar to how the internet was kicked off as well. So there's some similarities there.
Exactly. And just to go a little bit like the onion, the concept of onion routing, right? Like each one of these servers, these relays that you're talking about, that you explained very well, they have a layer of encryption. That's why they only know one piece of the information, right? Like, and the idea of these layers is where the name onion comes from. But so exactly how you explain it, you have this, when you're connecting through Tor, you're going through the first relay, and then that is a layer of encryption there that is protecting that communication between you and that first relay. And then the first relay connects with the middle one, where there's another layer of encryption where, it's only between those two relays communication. And the middle only knows the first one. They don't know who you are. They just know the communication that coming from the first one to them. And then the third one, the middle passes the information to the exit one, and that is another layer of encryption. So the exit one doesn't even know who is the first one. They just know the middle one. And all these protections also helps with the fact that it's decentralized. So people are running relays within the network. They will have a hard time trying to build a way to know the full path of the user, right? Like, so, and there is a lot of other magic, let's say, that happens under the hood to pick which ones that build the circuit. We call it the circuit, right? Like those three relays that you're going to be using. There is some other magic happening about the first one and some statistics that all to protect the users from different types of attacks. And that, you know, we know that could be possible to happen within the network that that we had developed to make sure that the different types of like calculations and statistics to make it harder for the type of attack to happen, right? Like, so it's just a very simplistic way of explaining it. Yeah. But there is a lot of other little things and details behind the hood, right, that helps protect the people's security while they're using the network.
Yeah, I'm sure we could do many episodes, and I'm sure many podcast episodes have been done in the past on the technical details of how the network works. But we'll leave that for another day. But you touched on it a little bit earlier, and you touched on kind of what you're hoping that users get from using Tor. And I want to maybe clarify or simplify it a little bit to just what is it that you would hope that users get from using the Tor browser specifically? Because we'll kind of shift focus into that, because most people are not actually interacting with the Tor network itself through like the Tor daemon or something like that. So what's kind of the key thing that you hope users get from using the Tor browser?
I think the main thing is the freedom to use the internet, the freedom to access information and share information without having your data, your information about you being harvested by companies and data brokers, or even worse, by being surveilled by the government or law enforcement or corporations without your knowledge, who are abusing your right for privacy and, you know, legal protection that you would have under certain practices, right? Like a warrant, for instance. So I think like the main hope that I have is that people have the freedom to access information and to share information while using Tor. And that's the main goal that we are hoping to achieve, and especially focus on, you know, bring through that exercise of access information, share information, to bring, the power for people to fight for human rights specifically. We really, our mission as an organization, the technology we develop and we create, our vision is that this technology help people who are fighting for human rights, and privacy is a human right, by the way, right?
Absolutely.
To achieve that. And that's the main goal we are looking for the users of our technology.
Yeah, I absolutely love that simplification. I mean, ultimately, privacy is important because it enables other things, and specifically because it enables freedom. And so Tor is providing privacy, but it's not just providing privacy to provide privacy. Like, I love that you simplified that down to it's providing privacy so that people can have the freedom to access what they want and share what they want. Just a hugely important and I think hugely clear purpose for using the Tor network. So there are definitely some huge advantages to using the Tor network. And we've talked a little bit about what that can provide to you. But what are some of the key limitations that users should be aware of when they're using the Tor browser?
I think like one of the limitations that I feel people need to understand that if you are using the Tor browser, it's like it will protect you in multiple ways. But there are, like, for instance, if you log into a service, they will still know your identity because you're giving your username and your password. Another limitation is that if you are browsing a website that does not have HTTPS, right? Like does not have an encrypted connection, you will still have your data being exposed while you're communicating with that website. I think we always wanted to make clear to users that whoever controls your entry point, like the network that you're connecting, that the internet provider, or if you are in a university, right, like the people who controls that network, they will know that you're using Tor. They will know that you are connecting to the Tor network. So that is like that's a very important point. And that's another thing that we can talk a little bit more later, which is about how we say that anonymity loves company, right? Like it helps to have a lot of people using the tool, because you, even if you feel that you don't need, I always tell people, okay, that's fine. If you think like, oh, I will use to do one search here and maybe access a certain website, but not all the time. And I tell people, leave the browser open on the background then. Because just to have that connection open, you're helping others who needs that protection. So I think those are and another important limitation that I want to explain to people is that there are certain threats that we cannot protect. If someone has access to your computer or your device, they can do a lot of things, including know that you are connecting to Tor. They might be logging your keyboard. There are certain things that we will not be able to protect you, but definitely like Tor is one of the most, the high standards out there that will be protecting your privacy as you're browsing websites. And we can talk more about the features that we have, but I want to make sure that it's not like there is no silver bullet here, right? Like, and there are some other things that combining, depending on how you're using the combination of factors, you will be in jeopardy. So I want to make sure that people have that also clear.
Yeah, you can't just start using Tor browser and not worry about any other aspects of privacy or security. It's not that kind of fix it for everything, just like no other single privacy tool is. There's not one thing you can start using that just solves all of your problems. But it can be a powerful tool in your toolkit that combines with other things, like making sure that your computer is not compromised, like making sure that the sites that you're visiting use HTTPS, or whenever possible, you use a hidden service that stays within the Tor network. There's a lot you can do, but it is definitely not the perfect solution for every single possible privacy or security problem, as it shouldn't be. Obviously, the focus needs to be on one specific thing, and obviously it's on doing web browsing right and really giving privacy and freedom to the user themselves. One thing we haven't touched on is just kind of the latency concerns when you're using Tor, because obviously since you're jumping through these servers that are run by other people all over the globe, you are going to have some slower connections and slower downloads, that kind of thing, compared to normal web browsing. Does that kind of limit the practical use cases that you recommend people use Tor for, or do you just kind of recommend them to use it for everything and just kind of get used to the difference in speed and latency compared to just a normal non-private network?
Yeah, I think like one use case that we don't recommend is torrent. But like I feel everything else should be all right. As a matter of fact, we know speed is a problem. It has improved a lot. If you haven't used Tor for the last 5 years and you use it today, you will see improvement on the speed. And we are actually working on a project called Congestion Control that for the past year or so, we have been experimenting and tuning this code within using simulators of the network and to improve how the load is balanced, you know, and being smarter about that within the network to improve speed. And we are seeing really good results. This will be out in the Tor release, in the next stable release, and we hope that, you know, it takes around 3 months or so for the or volunteers who are running relays, right, like who build, who are part of the network to propagate and for all of them to update and so forth. But we hope that around Q3, somewhere in Q3, that this would be already taking a great part of the network and users will start to see a great increase on the speed, you know, like in the velocity. So we know it is an issue. We have been dedicated a lot of resources on fixing it. And it have improved already for the past 5 years, but people probably towards the end of this year will see a big improvement. But nowadays, like, listen, like, people can watch YouTube videos. They can do voice calls or video calls even through Tor. And, you know, if most of the times is a reasonable speed, and I can talk a little bit more about little things you can do in case you get, you know, a circuit that is not that great, and you can just request a new circuit and, you know, we'll shift it around. We have a bandwidth scanner that helps with this, the selection of relays to build your circuit that are always trying to pick the fastest ones so people have a better experience. So we have implemented little things in the network to improve that, and a big change will happen towards the end of the year that people will see improvement. So hopefully this will help because it is slow. I'm like, I'm in Brazil. I know it's slow, you know, and we'll be, this change we are testing with, you know, entry points in different countries, and we are seeing difference between the speed where you are in Europe, where most of the network, right, like these volunteers and the relays are in the global north, which is another thing that we are trying to to decentralize from the global north, in order having relays running other areas of the world to have different entry points in the network to make that connection faster for the user. But yes, we hope that these elements of congestion control with the bandwidth scanner, all those little tools that we are implementing will help users have a better speed when connecting through the network.
Yeah, that's an exciting upcoming change. I had not heard about that. So I'm going to have to dig into that and kind of see the approach that's being taken there. But exciting that there are speed improvements. And like you mentioned, it's something that has been improving absolutely over the past few years. And as more people jump in and run nodes, and especially as you mentioned, as more people jump in and run nodes, not just with the same VPS provider, but run them from home, run them on new locations all around the globe, it helps to increase that speed because you can spread the bandwidth that's flowing through the network across more nodes and across more locations and get the entry points closer to the people actually using Tor. So it is definitely something that has been improving, but can be, I think, the first shock to people who jump straight from using just regular ClearNet browsing into using Tor. It's a very different experience because it is a bit slower, but it's also something that is very easy to get used to. And like you said, is rapidly improving. But you mentioned there that that you can get a new circuit when you're browsing in the Tor browser, and I've had some issues where, like, I'm going to a website and I can't get it to load, or it gets slow, and you're able to request that new circuit, start fresh, and usually that resolves that problem. Are there any other settings or features in Tor browser that you recommend that people kind of jump in and take a look at when they first start using it?
Yes, definitely. The new Tor circuit, right? Like, if people haven't noticed, when you are browsing a domain a new website with Tor Browser. If you click on the little lock close to the URL, you will see the Tor secret there, all the servers that you're passing through, and then you can request a new secret. The other one that I would say, which is important, is right now, when you you launch the browser, that is a button for configuring the connection. If it does, the connection does not happen for whatever reason, right? It fails. You can go to that configuration page, and I want to highlight this because sometimes the connection is failing because Tor is being censored, right? Mm-hmm. Tor is a great tool to bypass censorship, but Tor itself can be also censored. And in that configuration page, you can choose a bridge, which we can talk a little bit more, but bridges are Tor relays, right? Like servers that are part of a network, but they're not public. And that make it harder for the sensor to know the IP address and block it. We have default bridges, which are in the drop-down menu that you can select. And for whatever reason, if those doesn't work for you, you can also request a bridge. There is a button that you request a bridge, and you can, this is, we have like a bridge database that will, you're going to have to answer CAPTCHA, and then you're going to get IP address, and you will configure it to go through that server instead, and then connect to the Tor network. And this is being, you know, this is very important because sometimes people are trying to, they turn on the browser and the browser is trying to connect to Tor and is not, it's failing, it's giving them an error and they don't know why. And sometimes people have a hard time to understand that the problem is because Tor is being censored. We're actually also working on improving that usability, right? Like that user experience mm-hmm. to help the user understand that could be because of censorship and help them pick the best bridge for the country. Another feature I would say, we actually have the new identity feature, which is a little broom close to the URL bar. That one is very useful. For instance, if you want to make sure that all the information, Tor already, you know, we when you're accessing, using the Tor browser to access different websites, we isolated even each connections. We don't allow third-party cookies tracking, cross tabs, cross websites information sharing. We also block fingerprinting. We don't store anything. But if you want to kill that session, you initiate a whole new session that's completely clean, out of like any cookies or browse history from that session, you are and queue all the Tor secrets, all the connections that are happening. You can just click that row and we'll swipe everything. And that is useful. We are always in touch with our users. We are traveling to many countries where, you know, people are using the Tor, and sometimes we have encountered people where the Tor browser is installed in a shared computer. So people are using Tor browser and they want to just like swipe everything and make sure that everything has been swiped for the next user. So, and also sometimes you even have the cool cases of Tor being installed on library. So if you are a Tor user and you are in a library, you can use the new identity feature as soon as you are done using Tor, and just swipe everything for the next user. So just in case, you know, that's a great one. And finally, and we have the another icon near the URL bar, which is a shield. And that shield is where you can pick the different security levels that you can set your browser as you're using Tor. And we can talk more about the different levels. The standard one already protects you very well, but depends on the use case, you might want to change that. And you can pick two other levels, the safer and the safest level, to get a little bit more protections. That comes with the trade-off of some features from certain websites will not be working because we will be blocking things like JavaScript. So if you are trying to open something like Twitter, for instance, with the safest level, probably will not work because there's a lot of JavaScript on Twitter. So be aware of that, right? That's another little feature. And finally, if you are browsing different websites, I would ask you to pay attention if a little purple button in the URL bar will show up that says .onion available. If that exists, I would recommend clicking there, because that means that website has an Onion site available, and then connecting through Onion sites, you're not getting out of the Tor network. If I go, for instance, to torproject.org right now, I will get out of an exit relay and go to the clear web, right, the normal internet, and access Tor browser. And the exit relays will also, whoever, right, that has a log of the exit connection. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I'm just talking about torproject.org, but it could be a website that, it doesn't have HTTPS enabled, and then you are passing information, maybe your username, your password, and in clear text, and people are seeing that information, so forth. But if you do click on the Onion available button, and you will connect through the Onion site version of that website, the Onion address, right? And that means that the same way that I go to 3 Tor nodes to get to a site when I'm connecting to our website, the Onion provider also have 3 other nodes, and I'm meeting in the middle inside of the Tor network. So when you click on the secret display of accessing an Onion address, you're not going to only see 1, 2, 3 nodes. You're going to see 6. And that means that your connection is going to 3 servers, and the website, until you meet them, they're also going to 3 servers. And you meeting inside of the Tor network. You're not even leaving the Tor network. So you have end-to-end encryption right there. You also are obfuscating your metadata right there. So there's a lot of benefits by making that connection happening. Even if the website does not have HTTP enabled, you will be way more protected by selecting the only available option. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that was a great explanation. Those are all of the key features I was kind of thinking about. So you kind of nailed them all. The last one that you mentioned about the .onion pop up in your URL bar, I think was one of the best features that's been added to Tor browser in a while, and something that I jumped on with my websites to add that header into the config so that people who came on would see that pop up. And I also I prefer when I'm using Tor browser to enable the option to always use those .onion addresses whenever it's available from the website. And then when you enable that option, you don't even have to click the .onion available. Tor browser will just automatically see, okay, there's a .onion hidden service address here. I can just jump straight to that and not even bother with the HTTP or HTTPS site, which is absolutely awesome. It makes it a lot easier for people who are browsing to see that there's an onion address and not have to go searching through the website and trying to track it down and hoping they find the right one, all that fun stuff. So that's a very important feature for me, and one that I love that they all came up with and pushed out.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, it's hugely important, I think. Let's take a quick break from this episode to chat about the sponsors of Opt-Out, CakeWallet, and Local Monero. CakeWallet is a key tool that I use daily, as it allows me to easily and quickly use Monero for private by default payments. It's available on both iOS and Android, and is a fantastic way to get started buying and using Monero with a simple and easy to understand user experience. I regularly onboard new users to CakeWallet and hope that it will help simplify and ease your journey into cryptocurrency. If you're interested in purchasing Monero for the first time, or helping to bring others into a parallel economy, I'd recommend you look at using Local Monero, like I do, to buy and sell Monero while maintaining your privacy and avoiding invasive exchange surveillance. Local Monero is entirely peer-to-peer and is an important part of opting out of the surveillance state and into a parallel economy. Thank you to both sponsors for their incredible support and partnership, and I hope you'll take a moment after the episode to learn more in the show notes or at optoutpod.com/sponsors. And we've talked a lot about Tor nodes just kind of in the periphery. We've chatted about the role that they play in the Tor network. But like you mentioned, that's not something that there's like a central entity that hosts them all. It's not like a VPN where you're jumping through a company's servers that they own in a data center that hopefully they own or that they're renting space in, that kind of thing. You're participating in the network when you use it. You're jumping through nodes that other people are just choosing to run as volunteers, as you mentioned. So that's something that listeners can jump in and self-host Tor nodes as well. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about kind of how people can self-host Tor nodes or host them with another provider, but actually run the Tor node itself. And then maybe just some of the simple concerns that they should have, especially when running a Tor node from home. Because I think that can be a lot trickier depending on the type of node you're running. But yeah, just kind of walk through that, the node landscape of people who want to run their own Tor node itself.
Awesome. Yes, I love that question. So first of all, for the listeners who wants to learn more about this, I would recommend going to community.torproject.org/relay. That is our community page for relay operators. It has a lot of detailed information there, even like legal resources for folks if they need it, you know, or FAQ for them to, you know, have an idea about what is needed regarding being careful on that front. But let me start by talking about quad relays, which is the first relay in the chain of the three relays, right? Like that creates that circuit, we call it then guard. And the meter relay, those are the easy ones for you to run if you would like. Normally, you're not going to have issues with it, you know. The only thing that we do recommend is that they need to be stable and they need to have fast bandwidth. So in case you do have fast bandwidth at home and you want to run those from home, we also mentioned that because your setup is that you have a static IP address and you running your Tor server, and is also that static IP address is what your normal computer connection comes out. Because of the list of all Tor relays are public, including the guard and the middle and the exit ones, some ISPs or some servers might start blocking you because of it. So that could be an issue, you know, and you might have a bad experience. For instance, you might not be able to access your bank account as easy because of it. So we recommend that you have a dedicated IP address to the Tor relay and another one for your normal connections from home. That might not be as big of an issue if you are, you know, if you have dynamic IP addresses, right? Like a multiple static ones, like I just said. But we also, in case you're running from home, right? Like going back to running from home relays, another one that we recommend is a bridge relay because they're not public. Like I said, bridges are the ones that we keep it in our database. They're not part of, they're not listed publicly because they're used for users to bypass censorship. So we don't want the censor to know those IP addresses as easy. Otherwise, they would be blocking them. And then, you know, the whole purpose of circumvention would be killed very fast. So this would be a Tor relay that probably would give you less trouble with your ISP or the servers from knowing, you know, that connecting that IP address to a Tor service, right? Like, and be scary about it. In the way, I think bridges are something that is super useful, and they're super. They're not going to receive a lot of abuse complaints. They will, you know, not give you too much trouble, like I said. And they're super, super impactful for our users. We are just now coming out of a campaign for people to run bridges. We ran this campaign for like a month, and our goal was 200 bridges, and we are with over 1,000 bridges,
awesome.
Which I'm very thankful for all the volunteers out there who jump on this campaign. But I think if you want to collaborate with the Tor network, think about a bridge. You know, people sometimes think, the bridge I never use it. They it's so important that they exist, because when they're needed, we need to have them, and they will be used a lot. Right now, yeah. We're having a lot of cases of censorship against the network, and this is making a huge difference for users from Russia and other areas where Tor is being censored right now.
Yeah, bridges are one of those things you hope you don't need, but when you need it, it needs to already be there. So it's definitely something that it may never be used, and hopefully there's no need just because there's no censorship, but you need those bridge nodes ready and available so that when people are censored, they have something to jump through. So sorry, I just wanted to make sure people know how important it is that those exist, even if you run a bridge node and you don't see much usage.
No, go for it. I support your pitch 100%. It is super, super important to have those available. And so we can switch then, and distribute to users as quick as possible. And the other one, of course, right, like we had the exit relays. And those are the ones that have the greatest legal exposure, because all the traffic of the Tor, like multiple users are coming out of that IP address. We do not recommend that you run those from your home at all because mm-hmm. of that exposure. However, most of the complaints can be handled pretty easy. People who have run exit relays, normally they receive DMCA notice, and we have in our portal, community.torproject.org/relay, we have letters, like template letters, that you can easily send to your ISP, or whatever entity that are reporting those complaints to you. And most of the time, it's very easy to handle. It's not like we have folks who have run exit relays for a long period of time, and they haven't had like a lot of like big, they haven't had big issues whatsoever, just like small letters of complaints, DMCA or other like ISP complaints that are easily handled by these template letters that we support the community with. However, if there are legal issues, we also have recommendations, of legal support that people can go for different organizations, EFF, others have helped from different countries. So we try to build this community, right, like to give support to all the volunteers who are running exit relays or any type of relay from the Tor network. We also have, I want to do two other pitches.
Yeah,
one
go for
is
it.
That there are nonprofits out there that exist to bootstrap Tor relays in different places around the world. So if you want to collaborate with the network, but you don't want to go through setting up a server and taking care of it, you can make a donation to those organizations. They are listed on your community portal as well. And finally, I think, if you're short on money, that's fair, and you want to collaborate, that is another way that people can help. It is super easy. Anyone, like, you don't need to have any knowledge about running a server, which is with the Snowflake pluggable transport. In Snowflake, the way you collaborate, it's a web extension that you can install on your Firefox or Chrome, and you just leave it there running. And what is going to happen is that it's going to donate your bandwidth for users who are choosing Snowflake when connecting to Tor, right? Like as a bridge or pluggable transport to bypass censorship. Your IP address is not going to be exposed. The sensor will not know that you're collaborating with this bandwidth. Snowflake has a broker, right, where it collects all this bandwidth from all the volunteers who are running this web extension and is setting up the connection for the sensor users to use it as a proxy to get into the Tor network. And the cool thing is that, like I said before, one of the ways that Tor is censored is because the IP addresses for the relay networks are part of the network. Mm-hmm. They're public. They need to be public. We need to know who is out there. So we created at least like a snapshot of who is out there that, every hour, and public that list to the client so they know who is out there to build those secrets, etc. So one way the sensor can block us is by blocking those IP addresses. There's a more sophisticated way, which it is by package inspection, which is analyzing the protocol, right? Like, and being really smart about it. So Snowflake, what Snowflake does, it obfuscate, right? Like it cover up the Tor protocol and pretends to be a different type of connection. So with Snowflake, it pretends to be a WebRTC connection, which is the type of connection you have when you're doing Google chat, you know, like video chat. It's the type of connection, or Jitsi for the privacy supporters who are listening the show, right? It's that type of connection. So it pretends that you're having a WebRTC connection, a video chat, and that the game here is to make it super expensive for the sensor. So if they are to block every WebRTC connection out there, it will affect a lot of communication within the country or the region or whatever that they are trying to control the communication, right? Like, so it would be very expensive for them to do so, more expensive than just blocking the Tor protocol. So the Tor packages. So we pretend to be a WebRTC, and as soon as we bypass the sensor, we go through the Tor network, through that proxy, you connect it to the secret, and you are in the normal Tor network. So if you want to collaborate with Snowflake, you can go and install a web extension on your Firefox browser, and you're going to be collaborating. You're going to have a little Snowflake icon on your browser. You can click there, and it will, you know, you can turn on and enable and disable, and will also tell you how many users you have helped circumvent censorship with your, like, the bandwidth that you're sharing, which is pretty cool. And I have seen a lot of people sharing a screenshot of that, being very proud of collaborating to help someone have free access to the internet.
Yeah, I love that it does give you that just simple statistic on how many people you've helped out. Because I think that I would love to see that more in privacy tools where you can actually contribute, like, technically to the way that the privacy works in the project, because just really it's a great incentive for people to get a tangible number on how many people they've helped gain access to the internet, to gain freedom in how they access the internet. It's a huge piece of that. And if you listen to this and you do nothing else, I hope that you just go to the extension store for whatever browser you're using, if that's Chrome, if it's Brave, if it's Firefox, and you just install the Snowflake extension. It takes 2 seconds, and you don't have to do anything after that. But it is an awesome little tool.
Yeah, I can share mine right now. Mine says number of users current connected, 1. Number of users your Snowflake has helped to circumvent censorship in the last 24 hours, 34. So it's pretty cool. It's painless. You know, like, you install the web extension, and you're helping a lot of people out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that effort. It's a very fascinating way to work around censorship. And just a quick note on running a node. I've been running a middle and guard relay, or a guard relay, for about a year now. And the only issue that I've run into, I used to run one from home, and I don't anymore, but I used to run one from home. And oddly enough, the only issue I ran into was that Netflix and Hulu just started banning me and not allowing me to watch anything. So the wife wasn't very happy about that one. So the home Tor relay went away quickly when I couldn't get that cleared up. But I've been running one on a Hetzner dedicated server for a year now. And it's been awesome to see the amount of traffic that's gone through that. I mean, I think I average about 70 terabytes of data a day going through my Tor relay there, which is just an awesome way that I don't even think about it anymore that it's running. It's been painless. It stays up. I haven't had to do any maintenance there. It just gets updated with the rest of my system packages. And it's a great way that I can contribute there. But definitely whoever can run them from home or from other countries that are less saturated. I know Hetzner is not a great provider to run Tor nodes through, because so many people run Tor nodes through there. You kind of lose the some of the benefit because everyone's running through the same service. But that has been a fun project for me to be able to run that node and play around with it. And definitely would recommend people do that. The resources for running them have improved drastically since I started running a Tor node. So I love the new portal that you mentioned on community.torproject.org. It's gotten a lot better and is improving rapidly. But it's a great way to jump in and help to support Tor and help to support the people that are using Tor to gain privacy and to gain freedom of access to the internet. Just massively important. And thank you for mentioning so many different ways, Isabella, that people can step in and help in a technical and non-technical sense, because running Snowflake takes zero technical ability. If you can install any browser extension, you can install Snowflake and help people out that way.
And thank you for running a node. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Especially, yes, having a stable one, like a Guard one, is really cool. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's been great. It was one of the first things that I spun up and kind of started running as a public service. And it's been a fun experiment and a fun project to run, and definitely hoping to keep it up as long as possible and hoping to expand and add some more nodes soon, hopefully in new geographical locations, to start kind of spreading that out a little bit. So we've talked a ton about the Tor network itself, and I do want to touch just very briefly on if there are any tools out there that could be considered alternatives to Tor. I hesitate to say that like VPN is an alternative, but maybe you can touch on quickly the differences between using the Tor network and Tor browser versus using VPN. But if there are any other alternatives out there to Tor as well, I'd love it if you could just touch on those.
Yeah, I feel like there is I2P, there is NIM, and VPNs, like you mentioned, people, you know, it's more common that people jump on a VPN, right? Like when they're looking to hide the IP address. But I think that is the difference here, I would say, is one is the number of users, right? Like how many people are using the tool? Because like I said, anonymity loves company, right? Like if it's a new tool that is just bootstrapping, you're still kind of like a little bit exposed, right? Like there's not that many users. Another thing I would say, definitely like the open source aspect of the tool, right? You should look it up, because I feel one of the good things, the benefits that we have at Tor is the fact that we have a very active research community researching Tor all the time and writing papers about Tor. And thankfully, because our tool is open source, they can see the code, they can do experiments, right? Like we have this network simulator that is used by researchers as well. And all of this benefit us, because all the papers, all the information that gets out, it helps us improve our tool. Mm-hmm. So it's not only a validation, right? Like an audit that the users have about our technology, but it's also, if we were to actually put it in dollar value, the amount of like knowledge we receive from the papers, we would never be able to pay the people who are doing the research to give us this knowledge. And we receive this from all the researchers out there. So a big shout out for the research community and all the support that they, you know, they help us improve our tools so much. So we really appreciate that. And this is a huge factor, right? Like, it's not only like, oh, it is open source, it's one thing, but like, who's looking at the code? You know, who's actually like auditing this code? Who's actually writing about it and telling, okay, I found an issue, you know, like, or like, okay, it's good, you know, it has protections about this attack. Or we having moments where building defenses of attacks that are just in paper that haven't been executed yet because of the benefit of having access to those research results, right? Like, and so forth. So that's another big thing. And finally, the nature, right? Like of the decentralized nature of the network. I think this is one of the biggest things regarding VPNs, because at the end of the day, the VPN, it is controlled by one entity, and they control all the servers that you are using to connect. So you are literally trusting them, you know. Here you're trusting them when they say, oh, we're not looking at the traffic, we're not using your traffic, we're not analyzing your traffic. You need to give all that to one entity, the trust to one entity. At Tor, or beyond the fact that our code is open, there are people auditing your code, we don't control the network. It's decentralized. So there is no way that, like, the trust is by design, is not by wish, you know? Like, yeah. Oh, you can trust me. We even have a joke in Brazil about it, but, like, I don't know how to translate to English. But anyways, but it's by wish, I would say, right? Like, oh, I wish that this service is trustworthy, and I will just, like, you know, give the benefit of the doubt and you know, like, go with my hopes that it is what they're telling me that it is, you know. And with us, that is not the case. Like, it is by design. You know, like, I'm not asking you to trust me on the top project organization. It is by design. The code is out there. It can be audited. And the decentralization of the network is also a huge benefit. So that is one of the main, I think, counterpoint to the VPNs usage, right? Like, is the fact that you are just hoping that what they're promoting and what they're saying, it is true, you know, and there is no, most of the time, it's almost impossible to validate that. There is no auditing, there is nothing that you can see from a third party that validates what they're promoting, the benefits that they have, you know, that they're promoting to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a, it's a very important point that people understand that, that VPN services, they are by design trusted. You have to trust that they are properly handling your data, that they're not logging, all of those things. I mean, there are definitely ways that VPN providers can go above and beyond and can do third-party audits and have every piece of the client and server code open source. There are definitely ways that they can help to give some more transparency into that process, but it's always going to be something where you're having to trust them implicitly. And it really is a, it's a different focus for me between VPNs and Tor, because VPNs just really help you shift the trust model from the network that you're on at that moment to the VPN provider themselves. Whereas Tor helps you to shift the trust basically out of anyone's hands, because you're using a set of nodes that are run by different people that change every time you make a new circuit. And none of those nodes have total control over visibility into your traffic and can't log every piece of that transaction. So it definitely is a different focus, but it is very important that people understand that, like, a VPN is a service you have to trust, and Tor is not a service you have to trust. But there are some downsides to being decentralized and anyone running a node, which is that speed can be an issue, specific circuits can have problems, you can have malicious nodes on the network that can cause problems. There are some downsides there, but overall, it's a more trustless by design model, which is very, very important there.
Yes, and you're right. You know, thank you for bringing up the point about malicious nodes. There's a fact, it exists, you know, and we have, I would say, like 3 years ago, we would be in a terrible spot dealing with this situation than we are, you know, today. We created a team inside of Tor, call it the network health team, just to because of the need to have a dedicated team just taking care of the network, right? Mm-hmm. Like watching for patterns that could demonstrate that the relay is a malicious relay. That's another thing I want to say, right? Like one of the things that could happen, for instance, if you are connecting to a website that is not HTTPS, and you know, you get a malicious exit relay, they can be scanning your connection and being collecting all the information. So it's extremely important that also the service that you're accessing through the network mm-hmm. has encryption enabled as well. But that said, it's not just on you, right? Like it's on us as well. And we are creating tools and mechanisms to identify patterns of bad behavior, to quickly not only identify but kicking out this relays from the network. Another thing that we are investing a lot, and this year is going to be another year that we will continue this work, is the relationship with the volunteers. I think when Tor started, right, like in the early 2000s, kind of like bootstrapped by and there was this degree of knowledge, like I know you, who knows that person, we all running Tor relays, and so you know. But nowadays we have 6,000 people running Tor relays, you know, like so it's kind of hard to actually know everybody who is out there doing this. So we are in depth of with the community, right? Like we are in depth of building a good governance of the community. And governance not in a way of like, you know, like, oh, I'm going to control you, and but of a good coexistence of trust relationship being built, and also building, kind of like small communities that know each other, right? Like by regions, we are organizing I mean, with the pandemic, that kind of like slowed down, but we were organizing meetups, like face-to-face meetups as much as we could on events or every opportunity actually that we could. We recently had a relay operators meetup at CCC, as just happened through the, you know, New Year's holidays. And we are building more support on communication on the TOR relays, email list, on IRC. And we are investing a lot on regaining that relationship with the community so we can have, you know, like a health community, right? Like of operators. And through that process also be one of the ways that we can eliminate, right? Like bad relays or people that are not demonstrating goodwill, you know? So there are certain different checks that we are identifying that like, okay, if this person is not checking all these boxes, they're not demonstrating goodwill, goodbye, we're kicking out of the network. So I think this investment, it is, it have been proven, you know, often on the past 3 years, how important it is. And we have been able to react faster and identify and react faster to these cases. So the network stay healthy, right? Like that's the name of the team, network health. So the goal here is that we have a healthy network and that our users have a high level of trust with the network that they're using.
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on the risk of malicious nodes there, because that was, I think, a very important listener question that someone brought forward, which was kind of like what risks are associated if there's an exit node that's malicious or something like that. And are there any other node types that could be dangerous if that node that's a part of the circuit that you get is malicious or compromised? Is it a problem for like your entry node or your guard or middle relay nodes? Or is it really only the exit node that's problematic?
Well, so there is different types of attacks, right? Like, so it depends on, recently we have had one where they were overpopulating the network with relays, right? Like, so the more you have nodes on the network that you control, the higher is the probability of a CBOR attack, right? Like, mm-hmm. which it is, means that you're analyzing the traffic and trying to do correlation and guess that this is the one that this user did and they anonymized the user, right? So so that's one issue. So for instance, we are taking actions. We are trying to, being quicker when we see a lot of nodes coming into the network and identifying them as coming from the same, provider or operator, right? And doing that relationship and kicking them out, because sometimes it's not clear, you know, they don't make it that easy to for you to connect at different types of relays as coming from the same operator or the same entity that is operating that. So we are creating different scripts out there that like are over, like, I think this is always like, it's a type of work where every little bit that you learn, you apply and you get better for the next time, you know, because it's never going to be a clear game and they will be changing all the time. So yes, that like if someone has a big number of nodes in the network and they are malicious, they could be trying to do this correlation analysis. It's not easy, I would say, because one of the things that we do, for instance, is that not every relay can easily become a guard relay. And we another protection that we apply to the user is that a guard relay that is flagged as a good relay and the user has that, as the first entry point to build secret, they get stuck with it for a long time. So that's another thing that was like a kind of like something that we had to teach our users, because it would request a new secret and the middle node and the exit node would change IP address, but the guard would stay the same. And they were like, oh, there's a problem here. It's like, no, this is intentional, because statistically speaking, if the less you change, the less chances you have of getting a guard relay that is malicious, you know. So, and for you to become a guard relay, you need to receive a bunch of like, you cannot just put a relay on the network and will automatically be flagged as a quad relay. You need to pass a phase of like in the network for you to be considered a quad relay. So there's a lot of little things that we created over the time of the course of the years that to salvaguard, right? Like the what we're offering and what we're giving to the user and protect the users against different possible attacks. And just to highlight again, right? Like those exist thankfully to researchers and the papers where they proposed the solutions and we adapted them into the network as well. So yes, that can be, just to summarize the point, that can be different types of attacks. We are always in the game of trying to protect the users from them. Now we have a dedicated team that is proactively analyzing the relays that come to the network and kicking off, expelling the ones that we identified as possible malicious ones. And I recommend that the users, especially when not accessing our Onion site, accessing Clear website on the Clear web, to look for HTTPS websites, because there is another layer of protection on the top of using Tor.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for walking through all the details there. It's a very tricky one. And like you said, it's not something where you just kind of, oh, we've solved all of the problems. Tor is perfect now. No privacy tool and really no project that's based in code is ever to this point where everything is perfect. We don't need to touch it anymore. It's a constant arms race, especially in the privacy space. So you're constantly having to analyze what's going on, figure out what you need to change or improve, make those changes and start analyzing again and just constantly have that process. So it is such a valuable thing that the Tor network is so well known and it's so well researched because so many people want to better understand how Tor works, how it can be attacked, how it can be used. And so many people are putting forth that effort on research. So definitely very grateful for the people who have chosen to spend their time focusing on Tor and helping to make it get better over time. And the kind of the other way that people have helped to drive Tor forward is obviously funding. Funding is a tricky thing in the free and open source space. And obviously the Tor project is a nonprofit. So could you give us a little bit more insight into how Tor is funded or made sustainable?
Yes, of course. It is something that is always, right, like as a nonprofit, we depend on grants, we depend on donations. I just also want to take the opportunity to thank everybody who made donations last year during our year-end campaign. We broke records and we're going to be publishing a blog post about it. We also publish on our blog every year about our financials, right, like we kind of like the sack of our tax report, and we talk about the money that we receive. And we are, like, we do have grants from governments, especially the U.S. government, right? Like, this is part of our, as an organization, we want to be transparent. We don't hide any of that information. It's on our website. We not only you can have access to our tax documents and you can see that information, but we make sure that we write about it to make it easier for people to understand each bit of that. And we talk about, right, like we have our sponsors page where you can see who is giving money to Tor. So right now we are around 50% of our revenue comes from grants from different areas of from the U.S. government. One is the GRL, which is the Human Rights Department of the State Department. The other one is the NSF, National Science Fund. We also get funds from the Sweden government, not only the U.S. government. In the past, we have got from the German government as well. We receive funds from private foundations. We have grants with Ford. We have grants with Sloan Foundation. We had got a grant from the ZCash Mega Fund, Zong, recently. We also are super thankful for all the people who donate to Tor, right? Like there are individuals who make donation either by fiat currencies, right, like US dollars or whatever, but also through cryptocurrencies as well. We receive a lot of donations through cryptocurrencies, and it keeps growing, and we are very thankful for folks who do make a donation, because one of the things is that as a nonprofit, we do depend on grants, but the grants are, I think, are complicated, because mm-hmm. we are developing technology. So imagine, you need to think, you have an idea today, you cannot execute that idea today. You need to put that on a paper, send a proposal, wait 6 to 8 months for that to get approved until you can start working on that idea. That kills any development team, you know?
Definitely.
And so we want to have a buffer to be on our roadmap, right? Like that we can be agile. Also, we can respond to security issues, you know, or we can just focus on projects that are not part of a grant and just put that on the roadmap and have capacity or some time of our bandwidth, right? Like as people to work on those. And the way we can do this is through the money that comes from individual donations. So that money allows us to have that spot on our roadmap, you know, where we can do whatever we want because it's not tied to our grant proposal. And that allow us sometimes to start ideas quicker, you know, and not have to wait 6 months. Maybe we will have a proposal about the idea, but already in a more mature phase of the idea, we can bootstrap the idea with this individual donation money, you know. So the dream, I would say, would be that Tor would have more of this unrestricted money as part of our revenue, right? So we can be like any other tech organization out there, completely agile and just execute ideas as soon as we have them. The reality is far from it. Unfortunately, we still depend on grants. We are thankful for the grants that we get. Otherwise, we would not be here. But we still depend on them, and it slows down the execution sometimes. And we are hoping, and we have invested a lot. I have been part of Tor as an employee since 2015. I became executive director in 2018. And I can tell you from the moment I arrived at Tor, this has been one of the goals of Tor. And we have increased the piece of the budget that comes from individual contributions significantly. And it is making a difference, allowing us to sponsor a project or bootstrap ideas before we have the funding for it. One example I can give you that is recent is the Arte project. Arte was kicked off by Nick Matheson during a period of time without that way we didn't have any money allocated to Arte. And then Nick came with okay, I did this small client. Arte is an implementation of Tor in Rust. So we are rewriting the code that runs, all the relays run, all the Tor daemon code and the clients as well. But we're writing that in Rust. Right now it's on C. And it's terrible. It's like a spaghetti, you know, it's super difficult to make things better. It's not optional for mobile either. And with RT, we will be having a better API. So applications that are running Tor, right? Like we have a whole ecosystem out there that use Tor as a layer for the solution that they're giving to the users, right? Of protections. So that way will be much easier for them to do so. And Arte started with individual contributions. And now we have a Zcash Fund Foundation grant for it. And we are just releasing the 0.03. I might get the release wrong. Let me just double check. But anyways, it is becoming a more mature project. We have, 0.0.3. We have, with this grant, right, we hired people and, you know, Rust developers, and we are getting the project to move forward. But we didn't have to wait for a grant to get it started. And that's what contributions like that help us, you know?
Yeah, and so glad to hear that you have seen that percentage of the budget that you have grow and grow over time. It's so important. And I hadn't even honestly thought about the agility piece, about how it lets you focus on what seems best for the Tor network rather than what the specific grants are focused on. But the other piece to me is just that if that grant funding dries up for whatever reason, even if that's just that governments decide that we really don't like privacy and Tor provides privacy and we don't want to fund it anymore, and maybe academia follows suit and those things dry up, it's really important that the individual donors step up and have that base so that the Tor can continue operating, and not just operating, but growing and improving over time. But you did leave out the best part about donating to Tor is you can get some pretty awesome swag. So some of my favorite shirts are my Tor network shirts. So definitely a huge bonus there. I did have one more listener question for you that I almost skipped over. So I did want to touch on that, and then we'll close this one out because I know it's gotten a little bit long. But the last listener question I had for you was just what should listeners understand about pairing Tor with a VPN? So I know we touched on the differences between Tor and a VPN, but I think there's a lot of confusion around those people who like to use VPNs but also want to use Tor. Are there any kind of gotchas or key things to know about using Tor while also using a VPN?
Yes, I feel like one of the cases that people do that a lot is because they don't want, right, like the internet providers to know they're connecting through Tor.
Mm-hmm.
So they connect first to the VPN and then they connect to Tor. But the VPN provider will know that you're connecting to Tor. So,
for sure.
Right, like, yeah, so that is that, right? Like, I think we don't recommend, you know, because it is. For once, like you adding one more hoop there, right? Like, and we're probably gonna have like more issues. Another one is that I don't know what is worse, right? Like, you trusting the VPN or your ISP about you connecting to Tor. I think the issue again goes back to the point that VPNs are centralized services, and most of the time you don't have guarantee that who's controlling the VPN is, you know, actually respecting your privacy. And I feel that definitely going to choose that, yeah, to choose that, adding one more watcher to your connection, I'm not sure if it's the best solution for people. So we normally recommend people to just, you know, bootstrap Tor directly from your Tor browser. Another thing that, the main case that I see people doing this is because they don't want the ISP to know they're connecting to Tor, and they're trusting the VPN to be the watcher that knows that. So the downside here, to simplify it, is that you're adding one more person to watch what you're doing. So you're connecting to the VPN, and then so you have your ISP knowing you're connected to the VPN, and then you have the VPN knowing that you're connected to Tor. So I don't know if that is good or bad, but like in my opinion, it definitely is not a good idea to be adding more people watching what you're doing into the pipeline, you know?
Yeah, and I think the other piece too is that as the censorship-resistant tools within the Tor ecosystem improve, you shouldn't need a VPN for the purpose of getting around censorship of Tor either. Because I think that's another use case I hear people talk about, is if Tor is blocked, they can connect to a VPN and then use Tor. But the censorship-resistant tools in the Tor ecosystem are definitely more laser-focused on using Tor with censorship going on around you. So that's definitely, I don't think that's like kind of the ideal use case. It is interesting that people use it to avoid their ISP seeing them use Tor, which, like you said, that can be good if you trust your VPN more than you trust your ISP, but it's very much not necessarily a great thing. Like, you shouldn't, I would never like widely recommend that for sure. I think the other key reason that people like may use Tor with a VPN is because they use an always on VPN anyways, and then they want to use the Tor browser anyways, and it just happens to be going through VPN, which I think is probably one of the more common things, but going out of your way to use Tor with a VPN is usually not something where you're going to gain anything unless you have a very specific reason for why you want to do it and you understand the implications of doing that.
Mm-hmm. I know in the censorship case also, right, like you're right about the fact that, you know, with the tools that we have created to circumvent censorship against Tor, right, like they become more and more sophisticated. We have been working a lot on improving that experience. Every year, another thing that I'm very proud at Tor is the fact that for the last, 5 years at least, every year there is a major release of Tor browser with some big user experience improvement. You know, last year we killed the Tor launcher, and now you don't have the like window that pops out anymore. It just like it's part of the browser experience, right?
So
like
much better.
To the Tor. Yes, exactly. And we will have one this year where we are improving that piece about identifying that Tor has been censored and picking the circumvention tool. The circumvention tool, it's way more sophisticated and also will protect you much more than just going through a VPN to connect to Tor. So definitely try those circumvention tools if that's the case for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And usually if you're in the case where Tor is being censored, a VPN is going to be censored as well. So that's definitely not a normal use case that is ideal there. But yeah, thanks for jumping into that a little bit, because I think that's a common one I get is, oh, I use VPNs, but I also want to use Tor. How do those things interact? So great to get some clarification. Last question I have for you is really just how can listeners jump in and help support what you're doing with Tor? And I know we've covered a lot of this with running a node, with running the Snowflake extension, with donating, but are there any other key ways that people can jump in and help out?
Tor is about community, like everything, right? Like from being a volunteer that helps with translation, or someone who contributes with the code, or someone who reports a bug, you know, like jump to our forum. We have last year we launched a forum, forum.torproject.org. You can help reporting issues there. You can also support other users there, right? Like answer users' questions. We always need help, right? Like especially giving support in different languages. community.torproject.org also has a way for you. If you are someone who works with human rights defenders or other communities at risk that needs to learn how to protect themselves while browsing the internet, and you want to, you know, get the skills to become a trainer and learn how to teach people how to use Tor, we have materials for trainers. We have a lot of resources that can help you, you know, obtain those skills, and a community that can support you on that process. We also have, we don't at all collect data about our users. So we depend on help to get, to do usability tests with people. Normally the trainers, we combine the training with usability tests, and that's how all this improvement on Tor browser that I spoke of comes from that, comes from like talking with real users, real people, and just listening to their feedback and testing new UIs with them, seeing what works, what does not work, and improving the browser as it goes, you know, through that feedback. So if you want to collaborate with it, it's not like it's not a rock science. It's much easier than you think, and we have a lot of tutorials that to give you to that helps you do that work. You can we also have information if you want to collaborate by just letting people know about Onion sites and about Onion service and that this piece of technology that, you know, it's a plug and play kind of like feature for your website or a service that will give you all the benefits of the security and protections, privacy protection that Tor offers for free on your website. So if you want to be someone who advocates for that, it's another way to help Tor. So research, right, like we spoke about it. So there's 20,000 ways on how to help Tor. Please go to the community portal, go to the forum, and plug in. You know, please, like, we would not exist if it was not for our community. So we welcome a lot, and we try to do our best to support the volunteers that are collaborating with the project.
So glad that you stress community there too, because that's something that I try to kind of hammer home, is that community is so, so vital to this process. It's vital to privacy. It's vital to freedom. And like you mentioned, it's vital to a project like Tor. So definitely a huge part of that. But I just wanted to say thank you again, Isabella, for coming on and just taking this hour and a half out of your busy schedule and sitting down and chatting with me about Tor. I think it's going to help a lot of people better understand what Tor can do and can't do, and just give us a much better picture of how the tool fits into our toolkit. So thank you again so much for coming on and chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me, Seth. It was a great conversation. I really like it. And yeah, thank you for your work, for having such a great show covering privacy. It's a very educative show. So thank you for your work as well.
Thank you so much for the kind words. Definitely a privilege to be able to have these conversations and help other people on the journey that I'm on. But it's been a blast. So have a great night, Isabella.
You too. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of Opt Out. If you did, please take a moment and subscribe to the podcast, or if you're already subscribed, share it with one friend or family member this week. As always, you can check out the link to the guest content and contact info, as well as links to all of the tools we discussed in today's episode. Now get out there and opt out this week.